Now we wait at Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, Israel wants to eradicate the Palestinian people and the United Nations agency that supports them.
You know, it's a Zionist fantasy that you can just airbrush out of history an entire people with their identity, their history. It does feel increasingly as if this attempt to eradicate this population, its identity, and the organization that looks after it, that feels that it's part of a genocidal project.
And a Canadian Jewish group declares itself anti-Zionist.
Zionism can be accurately described as the Jewish form of white supremacy. It means the establishment of a state that privileges the position of Jews in relation to other ethnicities, in particular Palestinians. They're even willing to do so by making alliances with outright anti-Semites.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. This past September 11th, an indelibly dreadful date, 34 Palestinians were killed in a pair of Israeli airstrikes on a school in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. 12,000 were sheltering there at the time, most of them women and children. Among casualties, six aid workers with the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. Founded in 1949, UNRWA provides humanitarian aid, protection, and social services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, and is mandated to do so until a just and durable solution to the plight of the Palestinian people is found. That solution would involve fulfillment of the UN-mandated right of the Palestinian people to return to their homes inside present-day Israel or be compensated for their losses. Of course, Israel has had a hate-on for UNRWA from the get-go. Indeed, the Swedish diplomat responsible for the agency's formation, Count Folke Bernadotte, was gunned down by Zionist militants shortly after his plan for refugee Palestinians was tabled at the United Nations. 75 years later, in the course of its war on Gaza, Israel has killed at least 220 UNRWA staff with U.S. bombs and missiles. For thoughts on Israel's September 11th attack on the Nusayrat school, the GPM reached out to former UNRWA spokesperson Chris Gunness. We reached Chris Gunness in the UK. On September 11th, last week, six people, UNRWA employees, killed in a Nusayrat refugee camp in Gaza, bringing the number of UNRWA staff killed since October 7th to 220. This would seem to be a crisis for the United Nations. Never before, to my knowledge, has a United Nations agency, a formally constituted, historic, I might add, UN agency, been apparently systematically targeted by an ally of the West, no less.
It is extraordinary, and it is unprecedented, as you say, for a UN organization, a humanitarian agency delivering education, delivering health, delivering human development, delivering emergency food assistance of all sorts, should be attacked in this way. Just to focus on the school in central Gaza you mentioned, this had been used as a vaccination center for a UN-led polio vaccination center for 640,000 children in Gaza. So for Israel, the occupying power, which should be providing services such as polio vaccinations, actually to attack with disproportionate and indiscriminate munitions a school that was being used, that had been used to vaccinate children, is unconscionable. And it seems to me very clear that there is a war crime here, among many war crimes and crimes against humanity that have been committed in Gaza, that need investigating. And I have said all along, and not just with this attack, but others, that humanitarian agencies on the ground, including UNRWA, and I'm sure they'll be doing this very confidentially, very privately, if they're doing it at all, should be sending evidence to the International Criminal Court, which has opened an investigation against both Israel and Hamas, that the ICC may very soon be issuing arrest warrants against a senior Hamas leader, but also against Prime Minister Netanyahu and his defense minister, Yoav Gallant.
The pretrial chamber is now assessing.
Yeah, the three judges there are trying to make up their mind. But just to finish off that thought about the attack on the school, I do hope that the International Court of Justice, which is investigating Israel in a case brought by South Africa for genocide, that that evidence will all be sent, also be sent to the ICJ, because in its provisional measures ruling of the 26th of January, the ICJ was very clear that Israel should be facilitating international humanitarian aid. And of course, an attack that we saw on an UNRWA school, a UN agency, of course, would be a direct violation of those provisional measures instructions. To get back to the attack on UNRWA, yes, UNRWA has lost about 220. It's likely to be over because we don't know how many UNRWA staff are in the rubble and are simply unaccounted for. There's so much chaos in Gaza at the moment. But it's not just a military and literally physical attack by Israel on UNRWA. There is a political attack, which involves quite unjustifiably smearing the agency, accusing its staff of being involved. 10% of its staff, the Israelis have said in the past, are involved in the attack or were involved in the attack on the 7th of October. That is palpable nonsense. The two investigations into this, external and internal, have found absolutely no evidence of this whatsoever. There's also been an operational attack on UNRWA. So the Israelis are restricting the visas that they're giving to UNRWA staff, for staff to get into Jerusalem, to Israel itself, to work in the West Bank, but also into Gaza itself. As far as I'm aware, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, himself is being restricted in this way. The Israelis are also limiting the bank accounts that UNRWA can use in order to procure goods for distribution, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. And finally, the Israelis are also attempting to take away the lease on a huge compound in Jerusalem, which UNRWA uses as its headquarters for its West Bank operations, but also as its general headquarters, where the Commissioner General also has an office. So a political attack, there's been a financial attack. The donor community, after the accusations were made, 16 donors withdrew their funding, all but one of them, most notably the United States, which is UNRWA's largest donor. All the others have refunded, because clearly there isn't a case to be made against 10%, you know, 10% of UNRWA staff being involved in the 7th of October attack.
Chris Gunness, what does Israel have against UNRWA? How do you explain the state of Israel's hate on for the UN Relief and Works Agency?
Well, David, that's a very interesting and important question. So UNRWA has registered on its books 5.9 million refugees. And these are in part people who actually fled in 1948 from the war or were forced from their homes, and their descendants, because in all refugee best practice, and that includes UNHCR, the other refugee agency of the United Nations, the children of refugees, while there is an unresolved political problem, crisis, call it what you will, that prevents the refugees from returning peacefully to their homes and living in peace side by side with their neighbours. In those situations, the children of refugees are registered as refugees. So UNRWA does this as any other agency does. It's not unique to UNRWA. But for the Israelis, they have this paranoid fear that if UNRWA refugees were to return to their homes in Israel, this would dilute the Jewish character of the state. And Israelis find that very, very threatening. So they mistakenly believe that if they try to discredit, to smear, to defund, and to eliminate the refugee agency that looks after these people, then somehow these people will themselves disappear along with their rights, including the right of return. But that, of course, is a complete fiction. You know, if Oxfam disappeared, you wouldn't get rid of poor people. Similarly, if UNRWA disappeared, these refugees who desperately need the aid that UNRWA supplies would not just disappear. They'd continue to be human beings with needs and with rights. And the international community, the UN specifically, has an obligation to look after these people and to protect their rights. So it's a, you know, it's a Zionist fantasy that you can just airbrush out of history an entire people with their identity, their history. And given that what we're now seeing are accusations of genocide, it does feel increasingly as if this attempt to eradicate this population, its identity, its history, and the organization that looks after it, that that feels that it's part of a genocidal project. And of course, that is something which I think the International Court of Justice will be very interested in.
Well, for sure, the state of Israel wants the Palestinian people to just vanish.
Which isn't going to happen. That's like saying, you know, you want the Jewish people to vanish. Of course they're not. They're people with the right of self-determination, and no one's going to deny them that. But the Palestinians are also a people with the right of self-determination. So, you know, that isn't something which you can just, you know, magic out of the legal framework or history. I mean, they are there. They have rights, including the right of self-determination.
And it bears repeating, we talked about this the last time we had a conversation, that Israel has been attacking UNRWA since 1949, since even prior to its formation, largely steward into existence by Count Folk Bernadotte, who the future Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir played a central role in assassinating.
Yes.
And so people talk about UNRWA, you know, Israel's hate on for UNRWA today, but it really, Israel has been attacking UNRWA since day one.
Yes, I mean, just to be historically accurate, UNRWA came into existence through a General Assembly vote in December 1949 and then became operational on the ground on May the 1st, 1950. And certainly from the beginning, but certainly after 67, the Israelis have really increased their attacks on UNRWA. It's very interesting that almost as soon as the occupation started, the Israelis were attacking UNRWA for their textbooks. They say that the textbooks don't sufficiently reflect the narrative of Israel, the occupying power. You know, why would a subjugated people want to reflect the historical narratives of the people who were occupying their land and who had, you know, effectively dismantled their state? So yes, I mean, these attacks on UNRWA, decades old, but I think that with the advent of this right-wing fascistic government in Israel, with ministers like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are avowedly right-wing religious Zionists who espouse violence, I think they see this attack on UNRWA as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get rid of UNRWA. But as I said, getting rid of an agency that looks after people doesn't get rid of those people. It simply makes their plight more desperate and the need to protect their rights more urgent.
How crucial a role does UNRWA play in Gaza today, distributing and assisting in the distribution of humanitarian aid and providing health assistance and all that stuff to the people of Gaza, as well as in the West Bank, as well as in the refugee camps in the West Bank, where this UNRWA sanitation, individual engaged in sanitation work was gunned down the other day by an Israeli sniper who claimed they were a terrorist, an UNRWA employee. So how critical is UNRWA in providing services to Palestinians?
UNRWA's work is quite literally life-saving. I mean, even, well, before the war, UNRWA was distributing food to nearly 2 million people, and that means keeping people alive in Gaza. And now that you've got starvation, mass starvation breaking out, UNRWA's food distributions are literally life-saving. So UNRWA has continued to maintain some of its primary health services. It's continued to shelter tens of thousands of people in its facilities. It's continued to feed them in those facilities. It's continued to provide some sort of sanitation services. But to be very clear, UNRWA can only distribute what it can get into Gaza. And in the month of August, we've seen the numbers of denials of UNRWA aid convoys increase exponentially. There were just about 70 trucks a day in August that got into Gaza. And before the war, UNRWA was getting in 500 plus every day. So, you know, literally less than 20% of what is needed is being allowed into Gaza. And the other big problem is the north, because what the Israelis have done is built what is effectively a barrier across central Gaza along what they call Wadi Gaza. And in the middle of that, there is a checkpoint where, according to UNRWA colleagues I've been speaking to, increasingly ill-disciplined soldiers are being sent. A lot of the violence and killings that are taking place are happening around or because of that checkpoint. But it's very hard for UNRWA to get deliveries up into the north. Thousands of UNRWA staff stayed behind in the north. So there are UNRWA staff very actively working in the north of Gaza, where, of course, there are massive security problems that they're facing. But the real big problem for UNRWA is that Israel is simply not allowing supplies in at scale, which would allow UNRWA to do the work it's doing. And that is partly because there seems to be a policy, in spite of what various politicians have claimed, to deliberately starve people in Gaza. There's no other explanation for the fact that so few trucks are being allowed in. And, you know, this will be, again, of great interest to the International Court of Justice, who have made it very clear that starvation, the concern is being used as a weapon of war. And that is what Mr. Netanyahu, in part, and Mr. Gallant, his defense minister, are being accused of. So it is a matter of public record. People are counting how many trucks are being allowed in. And it is a matter of public record that it seems that starvation is being used, mass starvation, I should say, is being used as a weapon of war. So there are huge constraints being placed on UNRWA, but make no mistake, it is the only game in town. Sigrid Karg, the most senior UN humanitarian and reconstruction coordinator, has in an interview she gave very recently talked about the indispensability of UNRWA. UNRWA is the backbone. Without UNRWA, there can be no significant way of fighting off mass starvation in Gaza. So, you know, it's very clear, all from the Secretary General downwards, and I think many in the IDF realize that UNRWA is essential if we're going to stave off mass starvation and if the population of Gaza, frankly, are going to be kept alive.
And what's the situation with UNRWA activities in the refugee camps of Jenin and Nablus and...
You quoted the report in which an UNRWA worker was literally just shot dead by an Israeli sniper. So, of course, there's an atmosphere of fear and trembling in some of UNRWA's installations, some of the installations in the West Bank. It's terrifying. I mean, UNICEF put out a statement just a week or so ago saying that 150 children had been killed since the start of this fighting in Gaza. Increasingly, the Israelis are using military tactics, which we've never seen before in the West Bank, aerial attacks being used on a regular basis, aerial bombardments in the West Bank. We're seeing the Israeli army protecting right-wing settlers. We're seeing the Israeli army working alongside Israeli settlers to attack innocent Palestinian children, innocent Palestinian women being attacked in their homes being burnt, their cars being burnt, their livestock being killed, their water wells being destroyed. And I think, you know, let's be clear about this. The West Bank, which is where the majority of the religious sites are, is the main game. And I fear that, you know, Gaza may simply be a sideshow. And what we're beginning to see is the real ambition of this very cruel right-wing government in Israel roll out now, which is to seize and to continue with the annexation of the West Bank.
And UNRWA is based, if I'm not mistaken, in East Jerusalem?
Yes, UNRWA is based actually in three places, and that's because historically, shortly before the Intifada, UNRWA had been based in Vienna, and someone said, well, why would you have an organization dealing with so many millions of refugees in Palestine and in Syria and in Lebanon and in the West Bank and in Jordan, but not based there? So the headquarters was moved from Vienna to Gaza, but then the Intifada broke out.
The second Intifada.
They moved some of their staff, which they could, the Israelis allowed out of Gaza, to Jerusalem and some to Amman. So today UNRWA actually has three headquarters in Gaza, for those who can't leave Gaza because of Israeli restrictions, but also in Jerusalem and in Jordan.
And in East Jerusalem, I mean, UNRWA is still operating. Judging from everything that the Israeli government says, you'd think that they'd march in troops and shut down the office in East Jerusalem. They're cutting off bank accounts, they're cutting off funding. How difficult is it for UNRWA's office in East Jerusalem to operate?
Very, and don't forget, a few months ago, there was actually an arson attack on the periphery of the UNRWA building in East Jerusalem. But UNRWA is managing to continue, not at full capacity, unfortunately, but it is managing to continue with its services in the West Bank. But, you know, the violence and the insecurity has increased massively. About 600 people have been killed in the West Bank since October, and the violence there is intensifying, which, of course, is putting UNRWA's operations at greater and greater daily risk.
What would you like to see the international community, quote unquote? I always put international community between quotes because, of course, the international community, depending on how, you know, optimistic you are in the way the world works, is effectively the Western powers. The Western powers, the United States is the one that decides ultimately whether or not Israel is going to be sanctioned or not, and has the power to block it. But what would you like to see the international community do vis-a-vis protecting UNRWA? And what is it doing?
Well, the Americans have got congressional legislation which prohibits refunding UNRWA until at least next year. And the first thing I'd like to see the US do is restore its funding to UNRWA. The United States is the single largest donor to UNRWA. And when I look, gave approximately $350 million, it's probably more than that by the end, you know, before it was actually banned, American aid was banned. So, you know, American aid must be restored immediately to UNRWA. And I would like to see more multi-year agreements, because at the moment, many donors have got annual agreements, which means that UNRWA can barely look beyond the end of its nose. And when you're planning services, humanitarian services, schools for over 500,000 children, primary health services across the region, you need some kind of longevity to your partnerships. You need to be able to say, well, in 5 years' time, we've got people who we're going to be employing. UNRWA employs over 30,000 staff. Well, at the moment, they can only be assured payments, you know, on a monthly basis almost, and that's no basis upon which to have staff. So, of course, UNRWA must be fully funded. But ultimately, the paradigm that UNRWA is founded on is the notion that UNRWA will disappear when there is a just and durable solution to the refugee issue. So what, above all, I would like to see is proper political effort in order to resolve the refugee issue in the context of a two-state solution. Now, given what happened on the 7th of October last year, many would say that's a very long way away. Nonetheless, a military solution, either in Gaza or the West Bank, is impossible. We all know that. Hamas will not simply be defeated. It was a political movement. It's not just a terrorist organization. It's not just a resistance movement. It's not just a liberation movement. You know, it's many, many things. And the idea that you can aerial bomb a political movement was always an absurdity. So there have to be proper political negotiations between the Israelis. Hamas and other Palestinian groups have to realize that there's going to be a real risk of a repetition of what's happened in the last year unless they take serious steps to guaranteeing Israel's security. And Israel has to realize that there'll be serious risk of recurrence of what happened on the 7th of October last year unless they give the Palestinians a state. And, you know, I hope against all odds that that dynamic, those that dual realization will start to come into focus. But that's going to, you know, it feels like a very, very long way away. And if you look at the internal debate within Israel, there's absolutely no appetite whatsoever for making any concessions on letting the Palestinians have a state. In fact, you know, Mr. Netanyahu is on record as saying that he does not want to give the Palestinians a state. So, you know, behind all that looms the genuinely real prospect of a broader Middle East war with, you know, the northern border of Israel really, really seeing these terrible daily exchanges and the looming threat with Iran and the Houthis and, you know, and. So it's a very distant and somewhat forlorn hope. But at the end of the day, if you pull the lens out and you look long lens, there can only be a peaceful resolution of this conflict. There is no such thing as a military victory.
And it has to be based on international law.
Yeah.
Since the Oslo Accords, the paradigm has been the pathway to peace and security, not justice, but peace and security is through direct negotiation, face-to-face negotiation with the U.S. at the door, making sure that nobody gets in, and that the rule of law, international law, has got to be sidelined.
Yeah, I mean, no one is under any doubt that if there's going to be a just and lasting resolution such that Israel's security is guaranteed and that the Palestinians' security is guaranteed, that their statehood is guaranteed, that they are able to live within secure borders, that they are to be able to have the kind of security, the right to life, very basics of security that have been denied them for so long. If there's going to be a functioning state, if they're going to live in prosperity, if they're going to have human development, all of those things, the agreement has to be founded on international law. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, part of that international paradigm, which has been the paradigm on which peace in the Middle East has been envisaged for a long time, is land for peace. The idea that Israel or anyone else on the planet, like Mr. Putin, can just acquire land by force and keep it, if that is allowed to stand, then any dictatorship can just invade some country and grab their land and not give it back. We have to return to the basics of international law. And without that, the world is going to be a much, much, much more insecure place.
Chris Gunness, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Pleasure, David. Anytime. Be well. Thank you.
Chris Gunness is former chief spokesperson for the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, and the current executive director of the Myanmar Accountability Project. We'll link to the project's website and UNRWA at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Wikipedia, Zionism is, quote, an ethno-cultural nationalist movement that emerged in Europe in the late 19th century and aimed for the establishment of a Jewish state through the colonization of land outside Europe. A Jewish state in Palestine with as much land, as many Jews, and as few Palestinian Arabs as possible. Following the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, Zionism became Israel's national or state ideology. Unquote. In 1975, the UN General Assembly declared Zionism to be a form of racism and racial discrimination. In 1991, that resolution was revoked. Anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, Israel's allies and advocates insist. Tell that to U.S.-based Jewish Voice for Peace. the largest progressive Jewish anti-Zionist organization in the world. North of the border, Independent Jewish Voices Canada has just declared itself to be anti-Zionist. For thoughts on that stance, the GPM reached out to IJV founding member Sid Schneid. Full disclosure, I'm an IJV Canada member. I was deeply involved in the debate leading to the adoption of IJV's anti-Zionist resolution. Sid, can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and what your association is with Independent Jewish Voices Canada.
I'm one of the founders.